The Omicron surge is not over in Chicago, but City Health Commissioner Dr. Allison Arwady says she's cautiously optimistic.
All four of the key indicators that we use publicly are decreasing. Again, the cases, the test positivity, and the non-ICU beds are all very much in that very high transmission rate, but they are gently decreasing, and that is really good news. I don't want people to think that decreasing numbers here means that the Omicron surge is over. It is very much not over.
And I'll talk with Crane's residential real estate reporter Dennis Rodkin about news from the local housing market, including how the sale of million-dollar-plus homes in the Chicago area surged by 19% last year, the second big surge year in a row.
First time I've ever seen more than 3,000 homes sell for over $1 million in our region.
I'm Amy Guth, and this is Crane's Daily Gist for Thursday, January 20th. When it comes to a professional like your doctor or lawyer, you want someone who knows you well. Wintrust believes you should have the same relationship with your banker, someone you can call directly and know they'll understand your concerns. Thousands of local business owners called their Wintrust banker when they needed Paycheck Protection Program loans. They called, Wintrust answered, and helped more than 11,000 local businesses secure funding. Learn more at wintrust.com/dailygist. Member FDIC. Hi there, and welcome to Crane's Daily Gist Live, brought to you by Wintrust. I'm your host, Amy Guth, and I'm joined by Crane's residential real estate reporter, Dennis Rodkin, here to talk about news of the week from the local housing market. Hello, Dennis. How's it going?
Great, Amy. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. As usual, lots of things to talk about. Let us start with luxury home sales. I feel like we've been talking a lot about that, but you have some numbers as promised.
Yeah, so this is one of the year-end stories I do. We look at the different segments of the market. This one is sales at $1 million or up, $1 million and up, I should say. 3,480 homes sold in 2021 in that price category. That's up from 2,922 a year before. That's a 19% increase. First time I've ever seen more than 3,000 homes sell for over $1 million in our region. And let's be clear, that's the metro. That's not just the city. 19% increase. Unfortunately, at the time I was putting this data together, I don't yet have data for the entire market. But I think this is a bigger increase than the increase in the number of sales overall. This is huge. The last time there was an increase that was bigger is 2013. I wrote a story. I was at a different publication then, and I was tracking million-dollar homes, and the increase was about 30%, but that was really from almost no sales in 2012. 2013 was really when that post-2007 recovery really started kicking in. And what we've seen kicking in this time, both last year and this, is the COVID market, the pandemic market. It's a completely different reason for an explosion in the number of sales of luxury homes.
To me, to compare that with all of the other economic headlines, that's what's so stark about it to me.
One of the people I quoted in the story said, for people who kept their jobs throughout the pandemic, this has been a great time because they've gotten bonuses, their salaries have gone up in other ways, they've got stock wealth, they've saved money by not traveling and other expenses. So they're spending that on home. But the first part of that sentence really matters. It's people who have kept their jobs throughout the pandemic.
Well, I always say I appreciate you doing the math so the rest of us don't have to, but it'll be interesting to see what this year brings.
Okay. You know what the economists were saying at the two forecasts I attended last week for the city and regional real estate associations is 2022 may look bad because the growth won't be as much as it was in 2021, but you'll have to keep in mind whether it's prices, sales, and other things, you'll have to keep in mind that's growth on top of a boom. A couple of them said 2022 is likely to be the second best year, and the first best year is the year before, partly because so many people have already shifted in 2021. There are fewer to do it in 2022.
Well, we'll keep an eye on that number, I'm sure. All right. Well, speaking of the higher end of the market, we've talked a little bit about the Richard Driehaus Lake Geneva estate and how it went for sale. And there was a little bit of mystery around who was buying and all that. Anyway, what you know more now. Tell me that.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I still don't know who bought it, but I do know that it was bought. It came on the market in October for $39.25 million, sold at the end of last week for $36 million. $36 million is not only a record for Lake Geneva. If you combine the number two and number three highest sale prices in Lake Geneva history, you still come up $10 million below this sale. So they got $36 million for this. We've been over this a couple of times since it went on the market. I wrote about it. It went under contract. I wrote about it now that it is sold. But for those who aren't aware, it's a 1906 mansion that Richard Driehaus bought in 1998 and did a lavish redo of both the house and the grounds, developed the grounds with a children's village and all sorts of other things. It has 600 feet of frontage on Lake Geneva. It's a 13-bedroom house on almost 41 acres, and it sold so fast. It went on the market in October, it went under contract in November, and it sold in early January. I'm dying to find out. I don't think I will, but I'm dying to find out who bought it. I assume they bought it in a way that will conceal their identity, but you know I'm going to pick at that like a terrier trying to find it.
It's an interesting house just because Driehaus had it and he's such an iconic and interesting figure. But then you add in this, you know, very charming little children's village and all the stuff, all the space, all the beautiful details in that house. It's really quite a find.
It is. Yeah. And as rehabbed, it is just really a sumptuous mansion. I mean, it really is palatial.
And nothing wrong with having that huge lakefront. What was the size of the frontage on the lake?
600 feet of lakefront on Geneva Lake. I don't know that it's the biggest, but it's one of the biggest stretches of lakefront up there.
Yeah, not too shabby at all. All right. We've got a lot of different neighborhoods to hit today. Let's move to Bronzeville and what's happening with the Bronzeville housing market right now.
Well, so this is another year-end data story. I looked at where the most new construction homes were sold in the city. You know, I've been tracking the Bronzeville housing boom, the construction boom, for several years. In 2021, it was the place where the most new houses and townhouses were sold. That doesn't count condos. If you were to put in condos, it would be Streeterville, Near North, and West Loop. Those kinds of places would. But when you're just looking at ground level homes, Bronzeville pulled out ahead, 28 sales. Most of the neighborhoods with new construction homes sales were down in 2021 because construction was down, because materials weren't available and other reasons. But Bronzeville, the amazing thing is when I started tracking this boom, it was, wow, look how many new homes have sold for $500,000 or more. Now there's several of them are selling for over $700,000. And what's really started to turn is Bronzeville has long been an alternative. There are a lot of reasons to live in Bronzeville. It's incredible Black history. It's great accessibility to downtown. But one of the reasons as well is you get more house for the money there because land was so cheap for so long. But prices have gone up so much in the past few years that now, while Bronzeville was an alternative, there are people looking for alternatives to Bronzeville because of being priced out of Bronzeville. And it looks like one of those locations may be Fuller Park, which is immediately across the expressway from Bronzeville.
I always think that's interesting when a neighborhood starts to boom, where do people start to shift to when they can't buy into that neighborhood?
And this is one, you know, Amy, this boom in Bronzeville, I mean, I'm looking at Bronzeville from a very particular angle,
yeah.
New homes sold, but there are a lot of them. There are a few hundred homes that have sold for over $500,000 in the last 5 years in Bronzeville. People who aren't there, people who haven't been there, who haven't taken the L or driven past, have no idea how that neighborhood's been changing.
And it's a beautiful neighborhood. There's a lot of cool old historic homes and lots of interesting stuff in Bronzeville.
Yeah, mixing the new homes with the old, the new amenities with the old. That's why, as you know, we have this new podcast coming out on Monday, January 24th, where rather than just look at the individual dots, the individual sales that I've been doing, I've pulled together a lot of voices of people in Bronzeville talking about how it became what it did. I mean, Bronzeville was really created by Chicago's history of segregation. What's happening there now and what will happen in the future. Looking at Bronzeville through the lens I use on everything, real estate, going all the way back through its housing history and to today and forward.
I'm so glad you plugged the podcast. I was going to make sure that you did that today. We're all looking forward to the launch of that. That's going to be really interesting. I really love those kind of audio deep dives of any topic. And this is a wonderful one to start this series. All right, let's travel now to Woodlawn and talk about record prices there.
record prices there too. This is an interesting one. Woodlawn, for people who don't know, is the neighborhood that is immediately south of Hyde Park. They connect at the university. And a lot of the high-priced stuff I'm talking about is happening in the northern edges of Woodlawn near the university. A new home, a newly built home sold for $769,500 on Greenwood Avenue. This is an interesting project I've been writing about for a few years called Inspire Woodlawn. A man named Bill Williams told me, I think in 2018, maybe 2017, that he wanted to bring really great design, like what a lot of people are building on the north side, to Woodlawn. There's an architecture firm, Studio Dwell. They design houses in this style that have been built on the north side. He started building on the south side in Woodlawn specifically. And so he has sold all the ones he has built at these higher prices. And so now what he's going to do is, with very similar design, same designer, he wants to build half the size, half the price, build some affordable ones in that same cluster, so that we've come in and spent a whole bunch of money on a new house, and we are in a community with people who have spent less, but also have come in to the community and bought a new house and really sort of helped to pull together in that part of Woodlawn.
Yeah. This is a really beautiful house, like a very, you know, modern and very sleek kind of layout to it. I like how you've, in this design, you've mixed all the woods. You know, you have a different floor and kitchen, and then almost kind of the upper cabinets and the stairs all look kind of very different, but it works. It completely works.
So, you know, you're buying in Lakeview, you're buying in Bucktown, you're paying a couple $1 million. Here, $769 in Woodlawn. And again, people will be buying at something like half this price, a similar product, so that there comes to be this sort of cluster of new construction on the north end of Woodlawn. And one of the reasons to go with lower prices, I mean, this was his plan from the beginning when we spoke in, I think it's 2017, but there is a lot of concern about people being pushed out of Woodlawn. The Obama Library is coming in, there are other pressures, and the city made an agreement that there would be standards put in place to preserve affordable housing in the neighborhood. So he's following that lead and building more affordable homes, but he's already sort of, the proof of concept of this contemporary architecture is these higher priced ones, so that you get both. You get both the new people coming in spending a lot of money and the people spending less, but wanting to be in Woodlawn.
And I love the whole idea behind Inspire Woodlawn, of putting this really design forward, you know, initiative in place.
Yeah, you know, and I like coming in at the end. I wrote that he was going to build them. I'm really happy to come in and say he built them, he sold them, and here's the sort of complement to that he's building. I love this story like this. It's not, oh, pie in the sky, great idea, oh, and then it doesn't go anywhere. The upper price in Woodlawn has been rising as a result of his construction and another set of homes by a developer, Green Line. They're all, again, in those northern blocks of Woodlawn, immediately south of the university. But there's been a lot of change there.
Yeah, definitely. All right, now let's travel back up to the north side and head to Winnetka, on the market for more than $6 million, sitting on top of a bluff. Tell me about this place.
Ned Janata, he's now called Emeritus Chairman. I think he's 90. He's been with William Blair since 1959. He and his wife, who now is deceased, bought this house on the bluff in the year 2000. They already owned the one right next door, which they had bought in 1991. They kept both. They had two properties for a total of about 3.5 acres until 2010, sold the other one, kept this, and now he's selling this. So it's a little bit of a hopscotch. Buy one, buy the other, sell the first, now put the second on the market. It has stairs that go down the bluff to a private beach, would have had more private beach when they had the other property as well. It's a nice Cape Cod. I do wonder whether a buyer keeps it. It's a perfectly nice house, but most of what's been built on these bluff top sites, including the other one he used to own, are big new houses. So there is the possibility that this gets sold for the price of the land. I don't know that. We'll have to watch what happens. That Cape Cod style, you know, low slung, like I said, 1.5 or 2 stories, glass all across the back, because obviously you want to look at Lake Michigan. Really pretty house, and it's for sale at $6.25 million. As we said, he's owned it since 2000.
When he owned the two, was there plans to demolish and build something giant on the two lots? Or
it might have been that there were two different wings of the family in the two houses. They didn't talk to me back then when they sold the first one. didn't talk to me this time either. So the other property was a historical house. It was in 1860 when the Lady Elgin ran aground in Lake Michigan. That house was sort of an impromptu hospital. The people who lived in that house rushed out, pulled in some of the victims, took care of them in the house. So it was a historical house, but with no landmark protection. And after Janata sold it, it was torn down and replaced. And he did tell the Tribune at that time that he didn't think it was going to be torn down when he sold it. That much I know. That's not an answer to your question. That's a different piece of information about there being two properties. But that house was torn down and was replaced by one of these giant ones that I suggested is a possibility on this site.
I mean, anytime we look at these houses on bluffs, it's hard to even look at the house because your eye is immediately drawn outside to that beautiful view of the lake. It does feel like a little vacation house. It absolutely does.
It does. These lakefront, there are only a certain number of lakefront houses on the North Shore, and the views they get, it changes, as I've seen over the years. When you're in Evanston, Wilmette, where there's not really a bluff, you're almost at water level. Then you get up to Highland Park, Lake Forest, where there's about a 60-foot bluff. Two very different approaches to the lake.
Let's move now to Flossmoor. This is an interesting story. So Ken Norman, he lost the house to the bank in 2015, and now that his demolition is underway. Tell me what's going on with this.
You know, this was an eyesore. It's technically not in Flossmoor. It's surrounded on three sides by Flossmoor, and the current owner wants to get incorporated into Flossmoor before building. So Ken Norman, who played for the Clippers, he played for the Bucks, he played for the Hawks, he played for three NBA teams in the course of a decade. He bought a small house on this roughly 3-acre site just outside Flossmoor, across the street from Homewood Flossmoor High School, bought it in 1989 and built this house over and around the existing house. The existing house is in there somewhere, or the old house is in there somewhere. Built this house. It was really, you can tell, it was a showcase mansion of the 1990s. He then lost it in 2015 to foreclosure. Don't know how long it had been empty at that point. The mayor of Flossmoor told me last week she thought it might have been empty for as much as a decade, which would be about 2011-12. They might have moved out before it was foreclosed. But we know it's been empty since 2015 when he lost it in foreclosure. And what the mayor told, and it really is an eyesore. I have passed many times. I've written stories about Homewood or Flossmoor where people have said, oh, yeah, and then there's the Ken Norman house. It really is. It's a blemish. And the mayor said it also was a safety hazard. She found lots of videos on YouTube where people go in and they say, look, this is the abandoned Ken Norman house. And they punch holes in the walls and do things, and they graffiti it like crazy. So it was a safety hazard. The buyer bought it so let me go back. Ken Norman bought the property in 1989 for $430,000. In 2018, about 30 years later, the foreclosing lender sold it for $182,000, less than half what he had paid three decades before, not even including building that house. The entity that bought it is called For His Glory. It's a South Suburban developer. They want to build multifamily, most likely, not sure apartments or condos. They haven't developed or they haven't produced any specific plans yet. But part of their discussions with Flossmoor about getting incorporated so that they can get Flossmoor utilities was, can you please tear that awful thing down? So it sat from at least 2015 till 2022, if not longer, empty, vandalized, and finally was torn down last week.
Wow. I feel like that's a bold move to go vandalize a house and put it on YouTube. You're kind of like, hey, prosecute me.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting because she told me this and then I went on YouTube and I linked to one in the story, but I could have linked to like 12. And, you know, your face is visible and it's, hey, everybody, I'm at Ken Norman's abandoned house.
Bold move. Bold move. Well, I mean,
I see your face in any of those videos, Amy. You're in luck.
I was holding the camera, so, you know, not me. I don't think I've actually ever heard you use the word eyesore, ever. Usually you will find...
You go back, I lived in one once, but...
Fair, but, you know, usually you will find something to say about a house, like, well, you know, then it's different than the architecture around it, but no, you're straight up eyesore.
Well, I think this was largely an eyesore because of its condition. I mean, I don't think I ever saw it before it started being run down.
Yeah.
But, you know, boarded up windows, graffiti all over it. Pretty bad.
Fair enough to call it an eyesore. All right. Well, Dennis, what is coming up in the week ahead?
You know, Amy, I'm working on a story for which I hope somebody who's listening can help me. So we've talked about all these record prices, record volume of sales that has drawn in a record number of real estate agents. I have numbers from national, local, and regional real estate associations showing that there's been a big influx of new agents. So if anybody out there listening started in residential real estate sales in the Chicago area in 2021, please get in touch with me. I'd like to talk with you about why you did and drop it into the story.
Oh my gosh, this is like a bucket list thing that finally, like someone listening to the podcast can help you with a story. This is what I've always wanted to facilitate. I'm so excited by this.
I've been a total promotional vehicle today. I promoted next week, the Bronzeville podcast. I promoted this story I did. Can I sell you some health products?
Vitamins, some kind of pyramid scheme. Can we do this? Let's go. Well, it is Girl Scout cookie season, and I usually don't say no to Girl Scout cookies. So, all right. Well, we will hopefully lots of people will be able to help you out with that.
I hope so.
Well, thanks so much, Dennis.
Thanks, Amy.
Coming up, many large companies have promised to erase carbon emissions, leaving shareholders to guess at the bottom line impact of their plans. We'll talk about that and more right after this. Cranes Audio Studio is proud to introduce the podcast series, 4-Star Stories. It debuts with Bronzeville, reported in 3 chapters by Dennis Rodkin. Once known as the Black Metropolis, Bronzeville is being reshaped by a construction boom that is revitalizing thousands of vacant lots.
Home prices have soared to levels that buyers and sellers, even less than a decade ago, could never have imagined. Can this be done in a new way without forcing out longtime residents? And can it be done with respect for what's been there, including a deep reservoir of Black community and achievement?
To create a new Bronzeville that welcomes others, but that is still very clearly the heart of this unique Midwestern Black experience.
The Bronzeville series from Cranes Audio Studio is part of 4-Star Stories, Crane's ongoing effort to uncover Chicago's past, present, and future through the voices of the people who live and work here. Search 4-Star Stories wherever you listen to podcasts to hear the full trailer and to subscribe. Chapter 1 debuts January 24th.
This is the Cranes Daily Gist with Amy Guth.
City Health Commissioner Dr. Allison Arwady says the Omicron surge is not over, but numbers could be trending down.
They are gently decreasing, and that is really good news. I don't want people to think that decreasing numbers here means that the Omicron surge is over. It is very much not over. There are a lot of people right now, every day still, getting diagnosed with COVID, and a lot of people being admitted, more than 200 every day to the hospital.
Cranes government reporter A.D. Quigg is covering the story in detail and has more.
Chicago Public Health Commissioner Dr. Allison Arwady shared a bit of good news after weeks of surging COVID cases locally. Cases and test positivity are dropping, and hospital capacity is ticking upwards. Cases and the percentage of tests coming in as positive are still high, Arwady warned Tuesday. The Omicron surge isn't over yet. The city's still averaging close to 3,000 new cases a day, but that's down from days when the city saw nearly 8,000 new cases on some days earlier this month. Arwady's presentation noted she's cautiously optimistic that the Omicron variant has peaked here. The positivity rate is 12.6%, down from a peak of over 20% in early January. Those are both still in the very high transmission category in the city's COVID risk matrix.
On Tuesday, Ford Motor Company said it expects to book an $8.2 billion gain from its investment in electric vehicle maker Rivian for the fourth quarter of 2021, when it reports earnings February 3rd. The automaker carried a roughly 12% stake in Rivian when it went public in November after investing more than $800 million in the company. Although the two companies late last year canceled plans to co-develop a vehicle, CEO Jim Farley told Crane's sister publication Automotive News that Ford was still pleased with the company and happy with its investment. The Rivian gain was one of a number of special items that Ford plans to report when it releases earnings next month, also saying it would reclassify a previous $900 million non-cash gain from Rivian into its special items, which means that figure will no longer be included in its adjusted EBIT forecast. Automotive News also reports that in addition to the Rivian gain, Ford also expects a non-cash $3.9 billion full-year gain, including a $3.5 billion fourth-quarter gain from an annual reevaluation of global pension and other post-retirement employee benefits. The automaker will further record $1.7 billion in costs associated with repurchasing and redeeming more than $6.7 billion in high-cost debt in the fourth quarter, as well as a $3.6 billion non-cash tax special item related to changes in Ford's global tax structure. Frontier Airlines is returning to Midway Airport for the first time since 2015. The carrier, which moved its local operations to O'Hare a handful of years ago, will fly from Midway to 10 cities starting in April. The Denver-based Discount Airline will also reduce its service at O'Hare down to 4 cities, shifting service to several cities to Midway. Crane's John Pletz is reporting the story in detail.
8 years after it departed for O'Hare, Discount Airline Frontier is heading back to Midway. The airline will operate flights to 10 cities from Chicago's Southside Airport, joining rival Southwest and Delta as the only carriers operating from both Midway and O'Hare. Southwest began serving O'Hare last year. Frontier will continue serving a handful of destinations from O'Hare even after it begins service at Midway in April. The Denver-based carrier has a relatively small presence in Chicago, which is dominated by United, American, and Southwest. Frontier said its move from O'Hare was driven by a combination of lower cost and operational flexibility at Midway. Terminal 5, where it operates at O'Hare, is the airport's primary international terminal. It's being expanded as part of a long-term rebuild of Terminal 2, which mainly will serve international passengers on United and American Airlines. As part of that overhaul, Delta will relocate to Terminal 5 from Terminal 2 later this year.
As climate activists press for action to curb the climate crisis, McDonald's, Kraft Heinz, Mondelez, and others have recently vowed to reduce their net carbon emissions to zero by 2050. However, as Crane's Ali Marathi reports, they've had less to say about the costs of hitting that target, which is a matter of some concern to shareholders expecting investment returns.
In recent months, Kraft Heinz, Mondelez, and McDonald's have all set goals to reduce their net carbon emissions to zero by the year 2050. Companies around the world have taken similar pledges to help advance the Paris Climate Accord's goal of limiting global temperature rise to 1.5 degrees Celsius by that time. It's expected to be a pretty massive undertaking from these companies, with some of them having to overhaul product lines, get rid of plastic packaging, and switch entirely to renewable energy. The biggest challenge will be in their supply chains, which is where most of their net carbon emissions comes from. Think about McDonald's and all the beef farmers they have, or Mondelez and the cocoa they source to make all of their chocolate snacks, even wheat, those sorts of things. These companies are going to have to work with farmers to change how they operate to get to that net zero goal. In many cases, they may be relying on technology that doesn't exist yet or is still in the development phases. Many of these companies have not yet calculated the cost and the bottom line impact. That part remains a mystery. Ordinarily, executives subject proposed projects to rigorous analysis of likely costs and returns, measuring all investments against a minimum return benchmark. But when it comes to these net zero initiatives, it's not clear what investment criteria they're using. In some cases, companies have already rolled out benchmarks that they're watching, but it usually is not financial. Some analysts plan to watch for whether the cost of the decades-long effort could squeeze these companies' profits, pitting their climate agendas against their obligations to investors. Ultimately, that conflict would test their commitment to eliminating carbon emissions.
That's Crane's Daily Gist for now. Check in on our continuous news feed at chicagobusiness.com. Thanks so much to today's guest, Crane's residential real estate reporter, Dennis Rodkin. You can follow all of our conversations on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you like to get your audio on demand. And remember to rate and review Crane's Daily Gist because that's the best way for others to discover our episodes. Our show is produced by Todd Manley at Earsight Studios. I'm Amy Guth. Thanks so much for listening, and I'll meet you right back here next time.